It's Friday, February 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama's visit to Cuba next month is greeted by both praise and criticism.
Raul Castro remains a steadfast ally of Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela.
We look at the evolution of the Zika and Ebola viruses and a controversy involving the late singer Natalie Cole and the recent Grammy Awards provokes reaction. It's all ahead. Next month, President Barack Obama will become the first sitting U.S. leader to visit Cuba in seven decades. President Obama has promised to raise human rights issues and other concerns with President Raul Castro on his short visit from March 21st to 22nd. The Obama trip follows the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Havana last year. Stephen Wilkinson is the chairman of the British-based International Institute for the Study of Cuba and the editor of the International Journal of Cuban Studies. I asked him about his reaction to the upcoming Obama trip to Cuba.
Well, it's just amazing in terms of the turnaround in the relationship since the days of, George W. Bush. It was inconceivable that such a thing could have happened 10, 12 years ago. So it is quite astonishing. It is rather incongruous as well, because the embargo legislation is still in place. So unless something is done to change that between now and the visit, then it will be a case of the president of the country visiting a country which it would still be illegal for its own citizens to visit as tourists, which is quite an odd state of affairs, really. But it is really quite astonishing.
This will be, however, a controversial visit because there are members of Congress, particularly those members from Florida, from the Miami area, people of Cuban heritage, not just in Florida, but others. And also, though, from human rights groups who are very concerned about Cuba's certain human rights status.
Yes. Well, the human rights groups make similar complaints about the United States' relationship with countries like China and Vietnam. But it doesn't prevent the government from having very good relations with them or even actually giving them favored trading nation status. So those kinds of criticisms, leveled at Cuba, it is a different case. Cuba's record on human rights isn't anything like as bad as, say, Saudi Arabia or China's. So those kind of criticisms should be easily deflected by the president. The Cuban-American attitude as well is, they are arguing from a self-interest point of view. It does look a little bit petty from the outsiders. When you're sitting here in London looking at it, rather more objectively, it does seem like a petty objection. I think that their interest probably in the long term will be better served if there is a rapprochement, because it would allow for them perhaps to get some kind of compensation for the properties they lost in the longer term, or indeed a way back to the country that they vacated. So I think it's short-sighted of them to still stick with this attitude towards the island.
Well, and also, finally, I just wanted to bring up, of course, the U.S. still has this military base at Guantanamo Bay. Recently, of course, that has been a very controversial prison site in addition to other, military aspects there. How does this further complicate the U.S.-Cuba relationship?
Well, it does, because it's one of the main demands that the Cuban government has placed on full normalization. They said that there can't be full normalization until Guantanamo is returned to Cuba. So hopefully, perhaps, when the visit takes place, there will be discussions direct face-to-face between the two presidents. Maybe some kind of deal can be hammered out on this and the other issues that Cuba has with the United States still. So, it is a step further along the way to a full normalization, hopefully. And Guantanamo must figure in that sooner or later. I can't imagine that they haven't actually discussed this yet. I think they must have, behind closed doors at some point, discussed a pathway towards full reconciliation. because that is one of the key factors involved.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wilkerson, for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
Stephen Wilkinson, chairman of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba and the editor of the International Journal of Cuban Studies. But Mr. Obama's Cuban visit remains highly controversial with some. Jaime Suchliki is professor at the University of Miami and is the director of the university's Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies. He tells me his reaction to the Obama trip.
Well, I think he's going to Cuba because it's very cold in Washington and he would like to get some sun. I don't think beyond that there is significance to this visit. The visit by President Nixon and Kissinger to China had strategic significance. They wanted to separate China from the Soviet Union, had political interests. They wanted the support of China in the Vietnam War, and it had also economic interest opening China to American investments. Now, this is not the case in Cuba. Raul Castro remains a steadfast ally of Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela. He hasn't changed an inch his foreign policy since this negotiation began and the opening of the embassy. As a matter of fact, the Russians have mentioned that they have now facilities in Cuba to visit, and they will send their submarines and their planes to Cuba. So I don't see that this will advance anything. Cuba is not an important market for American products. Sure, they can sell a little more rice, a little more corn, open a couple of hotels in Havana. But this is not significant for the United States and definitely not significant for the future of Cuba. So I don't know what the president is trying to accomplish. He's made a number of unilateral concessions to Cuba without any reciprocal concessions on the part of General Raul Castro. So I think this looks like a dead end.
What kind of concessions do you believe that Mr. Obama should seek from Raul Castro?
Well, he should seek what the U.S. policy has been seeking in Latin America specifically for the past three decades, which is more democracy, freedom, human rights, elections. I mean, since Jimmy Carter, we've emphasized that this is our policy in the Western Hemisphere. All of a sudden, this president is making nice to a military dictatorship. So he's breaking with the tradition of American foreign policy. Not that this is all over the world, but in Latin America, this has been the policy of the United States.
And also the trade and economic embargo with Cuba remains in effect.
Absolutely. And that's up to the Congress. And I don't see any inclination of the Congress to change that policy, at least not in an electoral year.
Jaime Suchliki, professor at the University of Miami and the director of the university's Cuban and Cuban-American Studies. And now for a look at social media, I'm joined by Andrew Palshevsky. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, good to be with you. Well, we have a sad story out of Argentina where a bunch of people on a beach had seen a baby dolphin, and they decided to pluck this baby dolphin out of the water right off the coast and take selfies with it. And unfortunately, the baby dolphin died because it was out of the water too long. So on social media, this story starts on social media with people trying to take selfies and post those. But now there's been this outrage on social media over this as this video has made the rounds. Somebody took a video of the people passing this dolphin around. And so now, like I said, outrage on social media. A lot of people saying these people should be charged with crimes, you know, prosecuted for doing this because really it's terrible, and all for something that cool to put on Twitter or Facebook. So very unfortunate story there. But on a more positive note.
Oh, good.
Yes. Facebook is launching a new effort to help nonprofit organizations. They're going to have a new site that will help nonprofits raise money, give them more publicity. So this is something perhaps out of Facebook's recent PR troubles and their free basics program in India getting shut down, this may be a way for them to drum up some more positive support. But certainly something positive from Facebook and for nonprofits, a potential boon for them. So it's a very nice story that we can end with instead of ending with the sad dolphin story.
Well, that's good. That's very good. And to begin the weekend as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That's Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The
The United States District Court for the Central District of California recently ordered technology giant Apple to provide reasonable technical assistance to law enforcement agents in obtaining access to the data that's been locked in an iPhone used by one of the shooters in the December 2015 San Bernardino mass murder attack. In an open letter to customers, Apple CEO Tim Cook called the federal court order an unprecedented step which threatens the security of Apple customers. Cook says that Apple opposes the order and that it has implications far beyond the legal case at hand. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says that the U.S. Department of Justice is not asking Apple to redesign its product or to create a new backdoor to one of their products. A number of advocacy organizations say that they support Apple's position in this case, while numerous U.S. politicians, including some presidential candidates, have criticized Apple's rejection of the court order. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about controversy concerning the late singer Natalie Cole and the Grammy Awards. The Zika virus has been all over the news recently because of its rapid spread in South America. International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with Newsweek health reporter Jessica Ferger, who has more on the evolution of both the Zika and Ebola viruses and what has been done to combat them. These two have actually been known to researchers for decades.
The public has a sense that maybe researchers and doctors didn't know about these viruses a couple of years ago, but in fact, Zika was first identified in 1947, if you can believe it, and there were some researchers who were studying yellow fever in Uganda, and they isolated the virus in a monkey that was in the forest. And then Ebola also has a similar story. That virus was discovered in 1976 in the Democratic Republic of Congo in a small village. And so the thing with both viruses is that for so many decades, they really weren't much of a threat. Ebola was isolated in small villages that were really far away from overcrowded areas.
We know Ebola is a very serious disease. It often ends up in death. The threat from Zika doesn't seem to be as alarming, but it is a virus that can cause very serious complications in pregnant women and also their offspring.
The thing with Zika is that the infection is really mild, and for most people, the virus remains asymptomatic if they catch it. And for decades, nobody knew about this, the possibility that the virus could cause microcephaly, which is, of course, the birth defects that babies have been born with, specifically in Brazil right now, where they have malformed small heads, which means that they have underdeveloped brains. So because the virus wasn't seen as so serious for so long, researchers put it on the back burner and instead studied other mosquito-borne illnesses and developed potential vaccines such as dengue and yellow fever and West Nile.
These viruses, as they were originally discovered, were fairly well contained in their environments in Africa. Is it the fact that we have become just more of a mobile society that these things have spread?
Yeah, I think viruses don't know international boundaries, and air travel has really made it possible for pathogens that are isolated into very remote places to emerge in pretty much all over the world and become a worldwide threat.
These two have obviously gained a lot of attention in the scientific community to try to find a cure or at least combat them.
Yeah, with Zika, there's a lot going on now, of course. I think a lot of the scientific community and the public health community learned from the delay that they made with the beginning of the Ebola outbreak. And interestingly enough, the World Health Organization declared Zika a public health emergency of international concern a lot earlier than they did so with Ebola. And that label is basically something that is partially political, but it's really like what they use as their call to action.
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, just in 2015, had a $100.27 million budget, as you write, to research projects of this virus category. Just this month, though, President Barack Obama asked Congress for $1.8 billion. That's a significant increase in the battle against the disease. There are some promising outlooks for vaccines, apparently.
When I spoke with the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he talked a lot about this potential candidate. It was developed initially as a vaccine for West Nile a few years ago and went through three studies and was shown to be very effective. They're going to utilize the infrastructure and the research that was done on that to develop a vaccine for Zika, and they're pretty confident that the NIH will have a good candidate by the summer, and they'll hopefully begin trials.
You can read more in Jessica Sferger's article in Newsweek about Ebola and Zika, New Threats, Not New Viruses. Sferger spoke with my colleague, Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Nine-time Grammy winner Natalie Cole was one of several artists featured in the In Memoriam tribute on the recent Grammy telecast. However, her family has said they thought the brief tribute was disrespectful given Natalie's accomplishments. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the controversy.
Well, I don't know that I'm comfortable saying that it was disrespectful. I think those were more the words of her sisters and her son. I was surprised, however, that that was all she was given. I expected, because, as you say, she's a multi-Grammy winner. She'd been nominated 21 times. She had this lengthy career. She comes from this incredible musical family, that maybe they would do something similar to what they did for Lionel Richie, who is still alive, by the way. Even the tribute to Maurice White, who recently passed away, the founder and lead singer of Earth, Wind and Fire, sort of got a tribute onto himself.
From Stevie Wonder
and
Pentatonix.
Pentatonix, absolutely.
And
so,
a very good tribute, by the way.
It was fun. It was lots of fun. And right before an award, and again, it was only a few minutes long, but it was very clear that they were there to honor him. And I thought it was really interesting that she did not get the same thing. Disrespectful, I think, may be a strong word, but surprising. And the family was very upset. In fact, they released a statement. They said words cannot express the outrage and utter disappointment at the disrespectful tribute or lack thereof to a legendary artist such as our sister.
And Glenn Frey, the late Glenn Frey, the co-founder of the Eagles,
yes,
also got a tribute.
He did, and David Bowie, of course.
And the bass player for Motorhead as
mm-hmm.
well
mm-hmm.
also got a tribute. David Bowie, as you mentioned, got a lengthy tribute
yeah.
from Lady Gaga.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, the producers of the Grammys telecast have said, we thought that this was really appropriate because the video clip showed not only Natalie, but also her father, mm-hmm. and it had the kiss goodbye at the end of it, and it was the last of the tributes that were paid in this video clip.
Yes, yes.
And so, some people, I've seen some comments in articles that said, you save the best for last.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're justifying it that way. Do you think that's fair, that what they're saying about that?
It is their justification. I can't say, again, if it's fair or not. I think that they truly in their minds and hearts think that they did what they could. I mean, the producer said, you know, no one can do Natalie like Natalie. I've also heard people comment and say, well, you know, Gaga could do the David Bowie tribute because David Bowie as an artist, he was so visual and aesthetically it was lots of fun and we could do something appropriate for him in that regard. Whereas, you know, Natalie, maybe not so much. And maybe we should have just allowed her and in the video clip, her father to speak for themselves. It's hard to say. I can feel the family. And I think any family of any artist who has passed away would feel the same way. I think we all think that those who we love and admire should be acknowledged in a big way. So I see very well where the family's coming from.
I can understand that, too. Well, what do you think? Give us a shout on Twitter. You can hit up Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ. Mm-hmm. You can send a tweet to us, a comment or a question. We are at VOA_IE. You can also go to our website and post your questions or comments. That's voanews.com.
And that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently opened the U.S.-ASEAN summit in Sunnylands, California, stating that few regions present more opportunity to the 21st century than the Asia-Pacific. In order to take advantage of that opportunity, the U.S. has pursued a policy of engagement with Southeast Asia and ASEAN, which is central to the region's peace and prosperity. Together, said President Obama, ASEAN members can continue to increase the trade and economic partnership that create jobs and opportunity for people throughout the region. Over the last 7 years, trade between the United States and ASEAN has increased by 55%. The region is now our fourth largest goods trading partner, said President Obama. U.S. companies have been the largest source of foreign investment in ASEAN, one of the many reasons the region's gross domestic product has surged in recent years, lifting people from poverty to the middle class. President Obama urged ASEAN members to do more to encourage entrepreneurship and innovation so that growth and development is sustainable and benefits all people. ASEAN also has an important security role to play. In recent years, the U.S. has increased its maritime security assistance to its allies and partners in the region, improving mutual capabilities to protect lawful commerce and to respond to humanitarian crises. President Obama urged ASEAN states to advance a shared vision of regional order, where international rules and norms, including freedom of navigation, are upheld, and where disputes are resolved through peaceful, legal means. Political freedom and accountability continue to play an important role in the region. The election in Burma and the political transition underway there give hope for a nation that is peaceful, united, and democratic. In joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Singapore, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei have committed to high labor and environmental standards. As President Obama noted, strong, prosperous, and inclusive societies require good governance, rule of law, accountable institutions, vibrant civil societies, and upholding human rights. The vision that brings ASEAN nations together, said President Obama, is economic growth, creating opportunity for all, mutual security and the peaceful resolution of disputes, and human dignity, including respect for human rights and development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.